Tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 80s. And for Friday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, otherwise sunny, highs 88 to 92. More news is next on KAXE.
Even if you get a tax cut of $50, it's not that helpful if you then lose your Medicaid.
How President Trump's tax and spending bill will help the highest earners and hit the lowest ones the hardest.
Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, a clinic in rural Kentucky helps paint a picture of how cuts to Medicaid will make it much harder for states to provide health care.
Listen, I'm going to tell you right now, you take Medicaid away from this area, and it's nothing but dust.
Also, hip-hop mogul Sean Combs receives a mixed verdict. He's acquitted of the most serious charges.
And the Dalai Lama says after he dies, he will be born again.
Therefore, he says China cannot choose his successor.
Xi Jinping has adopted basically the same position as Mao, which is that in order to control Tibet, you need to control the Dalai Lama.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Members of the House Freedom Caucus are threatening to derail President Trump's massive tax cut and spending package. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the conservative hardliners have circulated a memo blasting the legislation.
House Freedom Caucus members argue that Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill will spike the federal deficit, water down repeal of Democrats' clean energy initiatives, and fall short of their demands for cuts to Medicaid. Members also say the plan should cut more funding from Planned Parenthood and contains, quote, excessive pork for Alaska and Hawaii. Their objections have stalled the mega bill's momentum a day after it was approved in the Senate. Claudia DeSalis, NPR News.
Music mogul Sean Diddy Combs will remain in jail until his sentencing date. Combs was found guilty today of transportation to engage in prostitution. He was acquitted on the more serious charges, racketeering and sex trafficking. In Wisconsin, abortion access is back after a ruling today from the state Supreme Court. Jimmy Gutierrez from Milwaukee Public Radio reports the court overturned a state law from 1849, which followed the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
The lawsuit was brought forward by Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call 3 years ago. In a press conference, Call praised the decision. He also called for the legislature to hear from Wisconsinites about the impact the law had while in effect.
For 15 months, women in Wisconsin had to experience something that for essentially two generations people hadn't had to go through, which was being denied the autonomy and the freedom to make their own reproductive health care decisions.
While the decision cements abortion access in the state for the first 20 weeks of a pregnancy, there's still questions. How will potential looming cuts to Medicaid affect the state's largest abortion provider, Planned Parenthood? And what will those cuts mean to healthcare providers in rural parts of the state? For NPR News, I'm Jimmy Gutierrez.
A coalition of civil liberties groups is suing to challenge a law in Texas that would require the display of the Ten Commandments in all public school classrooms. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
The groups are suing on behalf of 16 Texas families of varying religious and non-religious backgrounds. Sarah Kirsting Mum is with the ACLU of Texas.
Texas schools are not Sunday schools, and we need to remember that we all have a First Amendment freedom of religion, and it's important to be protecting that.
The groups leading the lawsuit also include Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a financial supporter of NPR. Supporters of the legislation in Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas all argued that the Ten Commandments are an historical document that underlies all U.S. law. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
At the close on Wall Street today, the Dow lost 10 points, the Nasdaq up 190. This is NPR News in Washington. Paramount has agreed to pay $16 million to settle President Trump's lawsuit. He was angered by the way CBS News edited and cross-promoted portions of a 60 Minutes interview with then-Vice President Kamala Harris. Trump suggested CBS sought to make Harris look better by airing different responses to the same question. CBS News disputed that claim. The government is lowering the recommended age for adults to get vaccinated against RSV, a respiratory illness. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. adopted the guidance from his hand-picked advisory committee, which met last month. NPR's Sydney Lupkin has more.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expanding recommendations for who should get a shot to ward off RSV. Now people at high risk between 50 and 59 will be eligible. That's in addition to the previous guidance for all adults 75 and older and those between 60 and 74 who are at increased risk for severe RSV disease. People who've already received the shot don't need to come back for another dose. RSV is a common respiratory virus with symptoms that mirror the common cold, but it can be deadly for older adults and infants. Pregnant women are also routinely vaccinated against the virus. That recommendation didn't change. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Hurricane Flossie has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm as it moves away from the southwestern coast of Mexico. The National Hurricane Center says it's located about 230 miles southeast of Cabo San Lucas, with wind speeds of about 100 miles per hour. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Association of Cass County Lakes has a presentation with loon biologist Dr. Walter Piper Saturday, July 12th, 1 p.m. at Salem Lutheran Church in Longville.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Senate Republicans passed their big tax cut and spending bill yesterday by the narrowest of margins. And now Republican leaders are trying to muscle the bill through the House. They're not getting a lot of help from budget watchdogs, who warn the measure could add trillions of dollars to the federal debt at a time when the government is already awash in red ink. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so there's been a variety of scorekeepers who've weighed in on this bill. What are they all saying about its effects on the federal budget?
They all say it would push that budget even further out of balance. The bill would extend many of the individual tax cuts from President Trump's first term and then also add some new tax breaks, so there would be less money coming into the government's coffers. The bill would also increase government spending on things like defense and immigration enforcement. And while there are some deep cuts here to safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps, those don't begin to make up for all the lost revenue. So the overall effect would be trillions of dollars in additional debt over the next decade. And just paying interest on that debt is already one of the government's biggest expenses. Interest payments will likely cost taxpayers more than $1 trillion this year.
Dang. Okay, well, supporters say the tax cuts will boost the economy. So how much extra growth should we expect?
Not a whole lot, at least according to the Congressional Budget Office. The CBO has not yet run the numbers on the Senate bill's economic effects, but when they looked at the earlier House version, CBO forecasters found very modest economic gains, and those were dwarfed by all the added interest costs. Economists at the Yale Budget Lab came to a very similar conclusion. Martha Gimble, who co-founded the Budget Lab and also worked in the Biden administration, says the U.S. economy is already in pretty solid shape, so more tax cuts and more deficit spending by the government just don't provide much of an economic lift.
There's less space in the economy for the spending to fill up. And so instead, a large part of the impact is just going to be that interest rates are raised, and that slows down growth.
In other words, all that extra government debt that comes from the bill would make it more expensive for families and businesses to borrow money if they want to buy a house or build a factory or invest in some new equipment. Now, the White House has offered its own forecast of what the bill would do for the economy, and that's much rosier. But most of the independent forecasters have dismissed those White House numbers as wildly optimistic. Remember, back in 2017, when the original Trump tax cuts were passed, the administration said those cuts would pay for themselves with higher growth. In fact, they never came close to paying for themselves, and instead the deficit soared even before the pandemic.
Okay, well, with all that said, passing this bill is a top priority for President Trump. So if Trump is successful, who stands to benefit and who stands to lose out?
Everybody who pays taxes stands to see at least a little bit of savings from the bill, but those gains are definitely skewed to the rich. When CBO looked at the earlier House version of the bill, they found the top 10% of earners, that is, people making around $700,000 a year on average, would see the biggest tax cuts, averaging about $12,000. Middle-income families would see a much smaller tax break, $500 to $1,000. And the poorest 30% of families, that is, people making less than about $55,000 a year, would likely end up worse off. Gimbel says for those families, the loss of government assistance like Medicaid and food stamps would outweigh any tax savings.
Even if you get a tax cut of $50, it's not that helpful if you then lose your Medicaid.
So to summarize, rich people get a big tax cut, poor people lose out, and those in the middle see a little bit of savings. Meanwhile, the federal government ends up with a much bigger credit card bill that potentially costs all of us in the long run.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Hip-hop tycoon Sean Combs was found not guilty of racketeering and sex trafficking by a federal jury in Manhattan this morning. The jury, though, found him guilty of two counts of a lesser crime, transportation to engage in prostitution. NPR Culture correspondent Anastasia Siulkas was at court for the verdict, and she joins us now. A warning, this conversation will include mentions of physical and sexual violence. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi there, Juana.
So I understand that there were two women who were really at the heart of the prosecutor's case, Combs' ex-girlfriend, the singer Cassie Ventura, and another ex-girlfriend who testified under the pseudonym Jane. And it appears that the jury was perhaps not convinced by their accusations.
Yes, Ventura and Jane both claimed that they had been sexually trafficked to various locations across the country to participate in drug and sex marathons orchestrated by Combs with male sex workers. And Combs referred to these as freak-offs or hotel nights, and they claimed that he had forced them to participate. The defense argued those were all consensual encounters, and the prosecution also claimed that Combs had used his vast business empire, which encompasses music, fashion, media, alcohol, and some of his employees to enable and hide criminal activities related to those sessions. But the government and their witnesses did not persuade the jury of racketeering or of sex trafficking. So after more than 13 hours of deliberation, this group of eight men and four women did find enough evidence to convict Combs on the two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution.
Now, to be clear, the jury did see and hear a lot of shocking, frankly, testimony and evidence over the 6 weeks of the prosecutor's arguments, but it seems that the prosecution simply did meet the bar in those specific allegations, right?
That's right. The jury, for example, saw videotape of Combs beating Ventura, and defense lawyer Mark Agnifilo, in his closing argument, literally said, quote, "We own the domestic violence," but physical abuse was not a federal charge here. And despite a witness testifying also that he and his colleagues received a $100,000 bribe directly from Combs in a paper bag, the jury did not find him guilty of bribery, which was one of the alleged crimes folded into the racketeering charge. So simply put, the jury did not believe that the prosecution provided convincing evidence of those two main accusations.
Anastasia, I imagine that Combs and his legal team must see today as a major victory.
Oh, for sure, Juana. Racketeering and sex trafficking, if they had been proven, carry sentences of up to life in prison. The prostitution findings have a maximum of 10 years in prison apiece, so Combs is facing a really vastly different landscape now, although that landscape does include dozens of civil lawsuits from former associates and employees still pending against him. And as the verdict was read, Combs collapsed behind the defense table on the ground and was just kneeling in relief.
You were there. Tell us what you saw and heard at court today.
Today, I was in an overflow courtroom, which, like every day of this trial, has been crammed with fans, tourists, TikTokers, YouTubers, as well as members of media outlets like me. And when the first not guilty verdict was delivered for the racketeering charge, there were gasps, cheers, members of Combs' family defense team starting to cry. Outside, shortly afterwards, just exuberant fans yelling and their joy out of this.
Last thing, what comes next for Sean Combs?
Per AP, the judge in the case, Arun Subramanian, ruled just a short time ago that Combs cannot be released on bail prior to his sentencing hearing.
NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsiolkas, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
After years of speculation, the Dalai Lama has finally addressed the question of his successor. Earlier today, the Tibetan spiritual leader said that after he dies, he will be born again. Omkar Khandekar reports from the Indian town of Dharamshala, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile.
For more than six decades, the Dalai Lama has campaigned against the Chinese occupation of Tibet. But he has been ambiguous about whether he will have a successor. This question was answered 4 days before his 90th birthday. To find out, hundreds of Buddhist monks, disciples, and journalists had gathered in the Himalayan town of Dharamshala on Wednesday. First, they prayed. Then a frail-looking Dalai Lama appeared on screen and slowly read out a written statement in Tibetan. He said the institution of the Dalai Lama would continue. A team of monks from his office will look for his successor as per tradition. And no one else would have a right to interfere. Analyst Kate Saunders says this last bit was aimed at China and its leader Xi Jinping. Saunders leads the Tibet research network Turquoise Roof.
Xi Jinping has adopted basically the same position as Mao, which is that in order to control Tibet, you need to control the religious elite, and in particular, the Dalai Lama.
Hours after the announcement, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said the appointment of Dalai Lama's successor will need Beijing's approval. The reaction only highlights the broken relationship between China and Tibet's exiled leaders. The two sides haven't had a formal dialogue since 2011. For Pempa Sering, president of Tibet's government in exile, the problem lies in Beijing.
We know for a fact that Sino-Tibet conflict can be resolved only by talking with the Chinese government. But till such a time where you have a Chinese leader with a common sense, right now the possibilities are very weak.
In the hours after the announcement, the mood amongst many of the Dalai Lama's followers in Dharamshala seemed no different. A busker played the sarangi at the marketplace outside the Dalai Lama temple. Elderly women sold Tibetan trinkets and little Lama bobbleheads. One taxi driver, Sering Thondup, explains that's because in their minds, Dalai Lama's reincarnation was never a question. In Buddhism, he says, everyone has a rebirth, a cycle known as samsara. That's how he says the Dalai Lama would be born again. Just like one day, he will be too. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Dharamshala.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock, you are listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxc.org. Support comes from the U of M Extension Forestry hosting the Minnesota Woodland Steward Program in Itasca County to help develop a deeper understanding of forest stewardship and manage fire risk. Registration open until August 10th with a discount for Itasca County landowners. More info at My Minnesota Woods on Facebook. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and tomorrow mostly sunny. Highs in the mid to upper 80s, winds from the southeast 5 to 10. Looking ahead to Friday, the 4th of July, scattered showers and thunderstorms likely throughout the day. Sunny skies otherwise, with highs 88 to 92 and south winds 10 to 15, gusting higher. The U.S. House of Representatives recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media that has already been allocated. This goes to the Senate next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-check news, community connections, great music, free to everyone with no paywall. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now is the time to act. Tell Congress protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. Grand Rapids Arts invites you to the first Thursday Art Walk tomorrow evening from 4 to 7. See art and artists at various locations throughout town, including the McCrossey Art Center and Old Central School. Find a full list at grandrapidsarts.org. You can learn about the trees of Itasca State Park this Saturday, 10:30. Meet outside the Lakeside Museum in the picnic grounds for a talk and a short walk.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This week, lawmakers here in California voted to reform a powerful decades-old environmental law. Loosening the law's protections has been a goal of housing advocates for years. They say the changes will help address the state's affordable housing shortage and homelessness crisis. But some environmentalists warn that the changes will have unintended consequences. Climate reporter Laura Clivens of member station KQED in San Francisco joins us now. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Okay, so just start us off by reminding us, what is in this California law exactly?
Well, the law was created in 1970 to combat sprawl and pollution and protect places like forests and waterways. It's called the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. Mm-hmm. It meant when you wanted to build, you'd go through a rigorous review process that takes a bunch of things into account, like the air pollution your building would add, the noise, the way it affects wildlife, and how much energy it uses. It's one of the strictest kinds of environmental review laws in the country. The problem, its critics say, was that over time, the law became more complicated and very lengthy and gave people a tool to stop projects they didn't like, even if their concerns had nothing to do with the environment.
Okay, so what were the changes that the state legislature made this week?
The reforms hugely streamline building processes. They make it easier to build housing in urban centers, and they'll exempt several categories of projects from environmental review, things like farmworker housing, childcare centers, and health clinics. Housing advocates and experts are excited about the changes. Alex Horowitz directs housing policy at the Pew Charitable Trusts. He says one of the surprising unintended consequences of CEQA was that it actually made sprawl worse. Because people complain more about building in cities and towns, those who wanted to build homes have found it easier to do so in far-flung places like forests or wetlands.
So the passage of these bills makes it easier to build housing in California. And it actually makes it easier to build housing in existing cities and towns where new housing does not need to be located in fire-prone areas, in flood-prone areas.
Okay, but as we mentioned, not everyone agrees that the changes to this law were a good idea, right?
Right. There isn't much pushback about streamlining building in existing cities, but the new law also allows what are called advanced manufacturing facilities to build in places zoned for industrial use. These are things like semiconductors and nanotechnology.
Okay.
Here's Frances Tinney, an attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity.
That kind of manufacturing creates major hazards for communities, and there's no setbacks. It can be near homes, it can be near schools. There's no limits on that.
I did talk to Chris Elmendorf, who's a land use and housing law expert at the University of California, Davis, and he pushed back on that fear a bit, saying most manufacturing facilities would still have to go through other kinds of environmental reviews. Now, environmentalists are also concerned about some other aspects of the law, like one that they say will no longer protect important habitats for endangered species, and another that will pause updates to building standards, which largely are meant to bring down planet warming pollution.
Right. Well, again, this is a California state law. Do you think it could influence more states to pass similar laws around the country?
Well, according to Alex Horowitz, the housing expert, we do see reforms in one state influence others. But we should note this is part of a bigger trend already happening. Numerous states have been passing laws that remove barriers to building. Horowitz says we saw a record number of them in 2025. Sometimes they're based on environmental review. We saw that in Minnesota last year. Sometimes they're based on other things, like in Texas. It's now easier to build because they've reformed something called a protest petition, which neighbors would use to block development.
That is Laura Clivens from KQED. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
In the hills of eastern Kentucky, what used to be a big box store was converted years ago into a bustling health clinic. Now with President Trump's tax and spending plan making its way through Congress today, which could cut billions of dollars from Medicaid, the future of this clinic and others is in doubt. Kentucky Public Radio's Sylvia Goodman recently visited healthcare workers in Appalachia.
Cars steadily trickled in and out of a packed parking lot recently on the side of a mountain in the small city of Hazard, where Primary Care Centers of Eastern Kentucky operates its main facility. Leslie Deaton, a nurse practitioner with the center for 13 years, says she grew up just down the road as she showed me through the maze-like facility.
It did. It used to be the Kmart. And so when I was younger, we walked up here. So to see this turned into my home clinic, pretty amazing.
Hospitals and clinics are some of the biggest employers here, especially after the state expanded Medicaid in 2014. State data show half of the people here are covered under Medicaid.
Since the coal is gone, you know, mainly it's healthcare here.
The Republican plan would cut hundreds of billions nationally from the program over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And nearly 300,000 people could lose Medicaid coverage in Kentucky, according to an analysis by the research group KFF during the congressional debates.
It feels to me like we're stepping back in time.
That's Tanya Brock. She worked as a nurse in the region for decades and serves on the boards of the Kentucky Rural Health Association and the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. Medicaid reimbursements keep many rural clinics in business.
So my fear is you will see hospitals close, you will see clinics close, and we'll lose those service lines that we have for these patients. And so it's not good. I have a great concern.
The people who support the Medicaid cuts say they'll eliminate, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. Kentucky Congressman Brett Guthrie told Fox Business most of those losing Medicaid coverage are able-bodied people.
These are people absolutely choosing not to work.
Opponents to the cuts say that new work requirements would end up kicking out many who have reasons for not working and those who don't report correctly. And another part of the plan has providers worried. The Kentucky Hospital Association says new restrictions on how much hospitals can get reimbursed will decimate the region. The group says the bill could endanger 20,000 jobs as hospitals already operating on slim margins close or cut services. Here's Jim Musser with the Hospital Association.
If cancer treatment goes away in your local hospital because the Medicaid dollars are gone, that affects everybody, not just Medicaid patients. And I don't think they've quite thought about the economic impact.
Back in Hazard, Greg Burke runs Beacons of Hope, a substance abuse rehab center. Appalachia has seen the worst of the opioid epidemic, and Burke says his program is almost entirely funded by Medicaid.
It's the only reason. That's how we function. That's how we operate.
Burke says the people he helps fight addiction are the region's future workforce.
Listen, I'm going to tell you right now, you take Medicaid away from this area, and it's nothing but dust. You're going to be left with basically abandoned little towns and probably some very, very sick people.
He says cuts to Medicaid threaten to set back years of work to combat poor health outcomes. For NPR News, I'm Sylvia Goodman in Hazard, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Our news team has also put together the ultimate guide for the fourth Up North. That's at KAXE.org. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Weather tonight, partly cloudy, lows near 60.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A missing Cloquet woman was found dead Sunday. Cloquet police began searching for 62-year-old Jane Corpola and her partner, 64-year-old Daniel Lateral, in late May. Both are vulnerable adults, and there was concern for their mental health and safety. The Aiken County Sheriff's Office found an SUV belonging to Lateral on Sunday in a remote area 2 miles north of Aiken. Investigators found a body nearby believed to be Corpola. Cloquet police found items of clothing belonging to Lateral near the scene during a search Monday. Search efforts are ongoing. Several Minnesota sheriffs and jail medical providers are suing the state over a new law concerning prescription medications for inmates. Chelsea Perkins looked into the lawsuit and has more.
The law requires jails to administer meds to incarcerated people if they were prescribed before they arrived. The complaint argues the law would take away discretion from local providers to determine what's best for the inmates and the situation. The sheriffs say it isn't always possible to confirm someone's prescription in a timely manner, especially because inmates arrive at all hours. Crow Wing County Sheriff Eric Klang is one of the sheriffs in the suit against the Minnesota Department of Corrections. He says they work to obtain medical records and confirm prescriptions as soon as possible. But in the meantime, they need to rely on the medical professionals in the jail and not necessarily take an inmate at their word.
You get somebody that comes in and says, hey, I'm on Ambien, but the guy's under the influence. We have to give him Ambien, you know, and it's like the doctors aren't going to, they don't want to do that, which makes sense because you don't want to mix alcohol and Ambien.
The lawsuit says complying with the law could result in harm or death to inmates and in civil liability for violating their constitutional rights. Not complying, on the other hand, could put a jail's license in jeopardy.
We don't take medicine unless we order the medicine, so we know exactly what it is. It's in a blister pack.
WCCO reports those who helped craft the legislation say the need for reform is because people have suffered serious health consequences without their prescriptions. The law was supposed to take effect on Tuesday, but Attorney General Keith Ellison agreed to postpone until August 1st while the court considers an injunction. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Internet provider Midco says the vast majority of its system is back online following the Bemidji storm. Midco teams identified over 300 damaged locations and say as commercial power is restored, smaller isolated damages to its plant are being repaired. The Midco Foundation also donated $7,000 to the American Red Cross to assist recovery efforts in Bemidji and Jamestown, North Dakota. Affinity Plus Federal Credit Union says it has donated $25,000 to recovery efforts. It's also offering a new loan option to support Bemidji and surrounding communities. Home equity disaster relief loans aim to cover a gap in requested funding and what's covered by insurance. The option is available until the end of August and is open to members and non-members. United Way of 1,000 Lakes presented this year's Volunteer of the Year Award last month. Danny Freyer fills us in on the winner.
This year's annual recognition goes to Shannon Antela of Great Tails Animal Rescue. Antela is the co-founder and president of the rescue organization. The volunteer-based shelter works to find permanent homes for stray, abandoned, or surrendered animals in Itasca County. United Way presented the award at their 2025 Community Impact Celebration last month. The other finalists for the award included Anthony Schaller with Itasca County Habitat for Humanity and Madeline Schumann with Grace House, as well as Dorothy Duquette with the Boys and Girls Club of Grand Rapids and Greenway. Danny Freyer, KAXE News.
The Superior National Forest Resource Advisory Committee will make funding recommendations at its upcoming meeting. The committee will consider Title II project proposals. These funds are distributed as grants for protection, restoration, and enhancement of fish and wildlife habitat, or for other natural resource projects that would benefit federally managed land. The committee will meet virtually at 1 p.m. Monday. Find more information at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. This week, Senate Majority Leader John Thune played a critical role in making sure that President Trump's massive tax and spending bill made it out of the Senate, setting up a final vote in the House.
Thune has done an incredible job.
That's Trump praising Thune at an event at the White House in May, but their close relationship is a dramatic reversal from their days as virtual political enemies. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
In the aftermath of the 2020 election, John Thune and Donald Trump were on the outs.
You know, I've never second-guessed the outcome of the 2020 election.
After the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Thune said Trump's actions after his re-election loss were, quote, inexcusable. Here's Thune during that same 2021 PBS News interview.
And it's created a lot of distrust of our elections.
Trump hit back at Thune, saying he was weak and should be primaried. However, by the time Trump won the GOP presidential primary earlier last year, Thune said it was time to get behind him. In March of 2024, Thune and his wife Kim made a fateful visit to Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida to put an end to the strife. It's formed the building blocks for where the relationship stands today.
His ability to be open has been helpful in getting on better terms with President Trump.
That's Lisa Hager, South Dakota State University politics professor. She says Thune's Midwestern style is disarming even to his worst enemies, and his pragmatic approach to policymaking helped unite the two.
He's very methodical. He's very good at looking at the lay of the land.
More than 20 years ago, Thune broke onto the national political scene with a Senate upset win over top Democrat Tom Daschle. He's pivoted on multiple occasions to match the current political landscape. South Dakota Republican Mike Rounds says Thune's appeal to Trump is clear.
For the president's part, he wanted to work with somebody who was willing to coordinate with him and that had the same interests, long-term interests for the country in mind.
That includes policy to cut taxes and grow the economy. Rounds says they got here by building wins together, and that's key for the president. That started this year with a wave of controversial nominees who might have had a rough time winning confirmation, but Thune cleared the way.
The vast majority of all of his nominees have been accepted, and those that were not accepted, the president was able to withdraw them himself.
Many say that led to delivering the ultimate win this week, Senate passage of that mega bill carrying the bulk of Trump's domestic agenda. During that Senate debate, Thune and Trump talked regularly by phone, text, and in person. Thune visited with the president at the White House, sometimes weekly or more.
I've been with him behind closed doors, and they're very, very close.
That's Senate Majority Whip John Barrasso. He says Trump and Thune together landed votes for the mega bill. Here's Barrasso.
We work closely together, and of course, from the standpoint of the whip, they're both key members of the whip team, and they're both very persuasive with the members.
That also meant Trump frequently met one-on-one with Senate holdouts who eventually folded under the immense pressure. It was the vote of one final senator, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, that Thune secured in the GOP's favor. For Thune's part, he tells NPR that being on the same page with the president makes all the difference.
We're both headed to the same destination right now, and that's you know, I've said this before, there's an alignment of incentives, and we've got reasons to work together, and it's working well.
Thune's relationship with the president will get tested again and again, and the results will dictate how much a deeply divided party will get done together. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
The demand for pet primates in the U.S. fuels a brutal underground market. But a new bill in Congress aims to change that by creating a national ban on privately owning and breeding these animals. Stephanie O'Neill has this story.
Here at the Oakland Zoo's Veterinary Hospital, across the bay from San Francisco, an endangered Mexican spider monkey leaps onto tree branches and climbs ropes in a large kennel turned into a primate playground. Her name is Violetta, and she issues these spider monkey greetings to a visitor. The young monkey, who's about 18 months old, was poached from the wild and smuggled into California, where it's illegal to keep primates as pets. In May, after her owner surrendered her during a drug bust, Violetta came to the zoo, and for nearly 2 months, handlers have been teaching her how to act like a monkey. Amber Foley is a keeper at the zoo.
We dedicate hours a day to just spending time sitting with her, socializing, grooming, teaching her how to play correctly, and interact in a peaceful manner.
The goal, she says, is to socialize Violetta well enough so she can live out her life at a zoo or sanctuary with her own kind. But for most pet primates in the United States, a life of chronic stress, malnutrition, and illness is far more likely, says Colleen Kinsley.
Anytime you see a spider monkey, a monkey with a human, the monkey is suffering terribly because it doesn't have its family and it doesn't have the opportunity, you know, to behave as a monkey.
Kinsley is vice president of animal care, conservation, and research at the Oakland Zoo. She says social media influencers, popular TV shows, and films romanticize life with primates, escalating demand. This fuels a brutal trade, one in which countless animals are killed while trying to protect babies from poachers.
What happens is a number of adults are shot out of the trees in order for the poachers to get hold of the babies, literally rip the babies out of the arms of the dead and dying mothers.
Yet many states still allow people to keep them as pets, something the proposed Federal Captive Primate Safety Act is aiming to change. If passed, it would ban primate pet ownership in all 50 states. Dr. Andrea Goodnight is a veterinarian at the Oakland Zoo who says keeping primates as private pets is bad for their mental and physical health.
It's completely abnormal for them. It has no idea what to do socially, how to function. So you can imagine the level of stress and anxiety that brings to these animals.
Many of the stolen infants who survived the poaching raids die during smuggling operations. Others, Goodnight says, survive the trafficking only to die from malnutrition or other illnesses before their first birthday.
Some of these animals are so traumatized that they'll just huddle in a corner and they won't come out, they won't interact, they won't eat, and they can literally starve themselves to death because they're just too scared.
For those who make it to maturity, about 4 years of age, she says life often gets exponentially worse.
As these animals grow and become more sexually mature, then they become super dangerous and people aren't able to handle them. And then a lot of times then you're stuck with this, well, what do I do with this animal?
And at that point, says Kinsley, there are few options beyond caging them for life or euthanizing them.
Coming to a zoo or a sanctuary as adults, often they're so psychologically damaged, you know, it's difficult, if not impossible, to get them back in a social group.
Colleen Kinsley says passage of the Captive Primate Safety Act and educating the public are key to protecting these animals. But since its May 5th introduction, the bill has remained stalled in the House Committee on Natural Resources, which has yet to bring it up for debate. Violetta's life, on the other hand, is gaining traction. Late last month, she left the Oakland Zoo Hospital and is now trying out a new life with a family of spider monkeys. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Oakland, California.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump is declaring victory in a battle against a news media titan. The parent company of CBS has agreed to pay $16 million toward Trump's future presidential library and legal costs. That is to settle his lawsuit over the broadcast of an interview 60 Minutes did with then-Vice President Kamala Harris before last November's election. Outside legal observers say the suit has no merit. So why is CBS paying up, and what does this mean for journalism? Let's turn now to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, just start by helping us understand why CBS's parent company, Paramount Global, is paying $16 million to settle this lawsuit.
So the co-CEO of Paramount Global, who's also the chief of CBS, told investors in a call today that this is the sort of thing corporations do. They get litigation out of the way. They save themselves legal costs and other distractions. And lawyers will tell you, for media companies and others, if you get into lawsuits, embarrassing disclosures can emerge. And certainly any news organization would be happy to have any private communications held secret. But you can't look at this settlement, consider this case, without thinking about the fact that it occurs at a time that Paramount Global and its controlling owner, Sherry Redstone, is seeking to sell itself in a deal valued at $8 billion to a studio called Skydance that's controlled by the Ellison family that is actually friends or supporters of President Trump, and that this deal requires approval by the Federal Communications Commission.
Right. Why is the FCC involved here?
So that's the regulatory body that looks over broadcast licenses. And CBS itself doesn't have a license, but 22 of the local stations that it does do. And the transfer of those stations to Skydance requires the approval of the FCC, which is led by a Trump appointee who has strongly indicated concern for the president's the reasons for suing and, in fact, has initiated a formal review based on very similar complaints.
Put this in context for us briefly, if you can. CBS is not the first news outlet to pay millions to make a lawsuit from the president disappear, right?
Well, if you look back not so many months ago, the Walt Disney Company paid exactly the same amount of money towards the presidential library and legal fees to make a lawsuit go away over mischaracterizations that anchor George Stephanopoulos made over what President Trump was found liable for in a private lawsuit years ago. That came with a note of regret. This one didn't, but it was clearly modeled on this. Similarly, you've seen social media platforms pay money, $25 million in the case of Meta, Facebook, $10 million in the case of Elon Musk's X, to make the president's lawsuits go away over him being bounced after the January 2021 siege of the U.S. Capitol by his supporters.
Give us a taste of what President Trump has had to say about the settlement.
His legal team is saying that this is a victory, that he's holding the fake news media accountable, that they have been engaged in deceit and deception and terrible things, and that he's going to take it to them time and again. And, you know, it echoes things we've heard from the president in other ways.
Last thought, what could this mean for journalism more broadly?
Well, you've heard him threaten to prosecute the New York Times and CNN for other for recent reporting, although neither has retreated. But I think you've seen major news organizations, not all, but major ones, bend towards the power of the president, not just in the case of ABC and CBS and their corporate owners, but in the case of the corporate owners of or the personal owners of the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times folks, billionaires Jeff Bezos and Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who have major business interests. When you have these other corporate interests from the owners of these major media outlets, those very much affect what they do in cases like this.
We will have to leave it there. NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks.
You bet.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 5:48. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear the set list in there. And at 7 o'clock, Annie Liu and Nelson, your volunteer hosts for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 80s, southeast winds 5 to 10. For Friday, the 4th of July, scattered showers and thunderstorms likely, otherwise mostly sunny, highs 88 to 92, winds from the south 10 to 15, gusting higher. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. You can mark your calendars for the Green Cheese Picnic Saturday, August 9th at KAXC's backyard in Grand Rapids. A potluck picnic begins at 5 p.m. with green cheese trivia to follow. It is Big Truck Day at the Virginia Public Library Thursday, July 10th from 10:30 to noon. See big machines and the vehicles that help keep our community safe. Fifth Avenue will be blocked off in front of the library for this event. And Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, July 10th at noon. This month, Dr. Daniel Larkin will talk about the invasive starry stonewort. And the City of Cohasset is offering Wednesday workouts during July and August, starting at 8:30 each Wednesday morning at Tioga Beach. All ages are welcome to take a walk that includes gentle stretching before and afterwards. Wear comfortable shoes and clothing. We continue with All Things Considered on People Powered KAXC.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration has shut down a website that's home to a series of major national reports on climate change. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports on what that means.
Back in the 1990s, Congress asked U.S. scientists to produce a series of reports. The National Climate Assessments were supposed to come out every 4 years, and they were intended to round up the best, newest research on how climate change affects the country. Over the decades, those reports homed in on one big point.
What the National Climate Assessment showed so clearly is that if you are a human being living in the United States, your life is already being impacted by climate change, whether you know it or not.
That's Catherine Hayhoe. She's the chief scientist of the Nature Conservancy and a climate scientist who has worked on several of the assessments.
If we don't recognize that, it's simply because we haven't connected the dots. And the National Climate Assessment was one of the primary tools connecting those dots.
Hundreds of scientists worked on the reports. They were used by policymakers, city planners, business owners, and regular people to figure out things like where neighborhoods might be endangered by sea level rise, or which places were most at risk during heat waves or droughts. Hayo says the reports also pointed out ways to solve the challenges.
The choices that we make today will determine the magnitude of the impacts we face tomorrow.
Urban planning expert Ladd Keith from the University of Arizona says the loss of the reports will leave many smaller cities or rural areas in the dark about their climate risks.
A lot of them rely on the National Climate Assessment because they don't have the resources locally to do their own climate profiles or to explore the impacts of climate change in their own community.
Geith says the loss of the reports, along with other federal climate data sets.
It's a little bit like watching the modern version of a book burning.
A NASA spokesperson told NPR that PDFs of the reports will eventually find a new home on a NASA website, but they don't know when. And there are even more questions about the next edition of the assessment, which was in progress and was supposed to come out in 2027. But in April, the Trump administration dismissed all the scientists working on it, including Keith. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
If you're a faithful listener, I don't need to tell you that every hour, 365 days a year, our newscasters tell you what you need to know. Often, the first place you'll hear breaking news on NPR is in those updates delivered by people whose voices you trust. Well, Jack Spear has been one of those voices anchoring afternoon newscasts for almost 20 years. And this week he is retiring, so he is here to look back on his tenure. Jack, it is nice to have you here in Studio 31 instead of the other side of the building where you broadcast the newscast from.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Ari. A whole different change of scene.
It's a much bigger studio
it
here.
It is bigger.
Most listeners know you as a newscaster, but when I started at NPR in 2001, you were a reporter on the business desk. How did you get your start at NPR?
Well, I was a local reporter covering business news, which I started doing about in the 90s, which was a time when you really didn't need to have like an MBA or anything like that. I had a lot of business experience because my father was a vice president of a titanium company. I learned a lot about business. And so in 1993, I was at WTOP here in Washington, and they said, hey, we need someone to talk about business. You seem to know about it. Why don't you do it?
You started at NPR in 1998. Is that right?
Yeah, I started in 1998. I came in actually to do a morning business segment with Bob Edwards.
Correspondent Jack Spear.
Good morning. Will this be the week Wall Street puts another one in the
record
spent
books,
the next 10 years running around in the field having fun?
What we call the angel chair.
It also helps if your master distiller comes from a long line of whiskey makers.
I followed in my father's footsteps.
The city of Cincinnati has around 3,000 miles of sewers. The large pipe we're standing in at the moment is spewing an unsavory greenish-brown mix.
A lot of things relieve themselves into this thing, sort of a little potty humor there.
There are plenty of things that make this plant different. There are, of course.
When I think about the news events that have happened during your career at NPR, it's all of the enormous things of the last, this century that we're living in. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about one of your most memorable days on the air?
The most memorable time for me would have to have been 9/11. I mean,
what were you actually doing in the days after 9/11?
I think I spent about, I don't know, a week, 10 days. I don't even think I even went home much. I was mostly here, and I worked with Scott Simon overnight, and I was Scott's studio buddy.
Because I remember NPR stood up a kind of call-in show between All Things Considered and the beginning of Morning Edition.
Yep. This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon in Washington, D.C.
I refer to it kind of as like sort of like a national hand-holding almost.
Scott, good morning.
And how are the overseas and financial markets reacting?
Well, you know, in the clear, cold light of day, less than 24 hours after this horrific series of events, and the rest of the world has now had some time to absorb some of this. And we would take calls from people, and Scott would answer people's questions, and, you know, we tried to provide the information we could provide.
We could take a call from Priscilla in Winthrop, Maine. Priscilla, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, Scott, thank you. I am...
And for the 18 years that you've been on the newscast unit, how do you think about that role? It's different from being a reporter or being the host of a program like All Things Considered.
Very different. And the things about being a newscaster, one, there's a situational awareness that you have to have with that job because you live in maybe such small boxes and they're very confined. 2 minutes and 59 seconds in the front and 1 minute and 39 seconds in the back, which is where I mostly live. But you have to have the ability to tell stories in an interesting and compelling way, and you have to have the ability to make changes almost instantly.
Right.
I mean, we can be 30 seconds from air and my producer, Nathan Thompson, can tell me, hey, this just happened, and he can talk in my ear, and we can make a change, and we do.
Whether it's an earthquake in this country, or the president just signed this bill into law, or bombs dropping on who knows where.
Yep, and it happens every day, and we have to get it right.
What are you going to miss about it?
I'm going to miss the pace, I'm sure. I think I'll miss a lot of the deadline pressures that I've grown very accustomed to over all this time. There are things that I really am interested in doing that I can't do if I continue to do what I'm doing. And teaching would be a big thing for me. I'm an adjunct instructor at Johns Hopkins and teach business communications and ethics. So very different from what I do on a daily basis.
NPR's Jack Spear, it's been an honor to call you a colleague. Congratulations on your retirement. I look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thanks, Ori. Appreciate it. Good luck to everyone.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may also find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for your support. Up ahead, it is As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7 o'clock, Annie Lou and Nelson, your volunteer hosts for On the River. Support comes from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel.